My guests today on the phone are Win Lee and Julian Cho, both journalists from Zoom in Korea, an online resource for progressive-minded individuals and groups interested in Korean issues, particularly exploring topics relating to the fight for democracy in South Korea and peace and reunification on the Korean Peninsula. Welcome to Takes on the World, Win Lee and Julian Cho.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. Julian, let's start with you first. The firing of four missiles into the Sea of Japan by North Korea clearly represented an upgrade in its military capabilities, and the announced threat to build an ICBM able to reach the West Coast of the United States has upset Japan and, of course, Washington. Given that the military exercises that the U.S. military conducts annually with the ROK, the Korean South Korean Army, are intended to keep North Korea in its place, are not the efforts of North Korea to improve the ability to defend itself against the U.S. attack somewhat understandable?
Well, the U.S. has had a huge influence over the South Korean military historically, and you know, a lot of it for its own interests. South Korea still hosts 28,500 U.S. troops, along with U.S. strategic weapons like the weaponized drones and other assets, other weapons that conduct regular military exercises, as you mentioned. And they threaten to basically invade North Korea and decapitate the leadership of North Korea, threatening to the sovereignty of the whole region and really keep all the countries in the region at bay.
Well,
add to that a little bit. You know, I think we need to look at it from a historical context. So many people don't realize that the U.S. has maintained a nuclear first strike threat against North Korea for a long time. From 1958 to 1991, the U.S. had hundreds of nuclear weapons in Korea. So in response to that, North Korea forward deployed conventional forces near the DMZ in order to basically create mutual deterrence. In 2001, people will remember George W. Bush famously announced North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil and made doctrinal changes that gave the U.S. preemptive strike advantage. North Korea was listed as one of seven countries that were targets of potential U.S. preemptive strike. And so in response to that, North Korea needed a new kind of deterrence, and that's when it really turned to developing nuclear weapons. And now the U.S. and South Korean militaries are developing missile defense capability, basically to take out North Korea's nuclear weapon capability. So then what's happening now in response is that North Korea is developing countermeasures basically to evade the missile defense systems. So, for example, launching missiles from mobile launchers that can be sort of, you know, movable, and they can move their missiles anywhere and launch them from any place in North Korea. Also submarine-based ballistic missiles, missiles, simultaneous launching of multiple missiles, so that, you know, at least one or two of them can evade the missile defense system, missiles that fly in an unpredictable pattern, like in a zigzag pattern. That's what the most recent North Korean missile tests were about. They were in response to U.S. development and deployment of missile defense systems that basically threatened U.S. first nuclear first strike. I think there is a double standard in U.S. condemnation of North Korea's missile tests. The U.S. continually tests ballistic missiles. So, for example, in 2015 alone, the U.S. flight tested the Minuteman III, which is an ICBM, from its Air Force in California five times in 2015 alone. You know, as I'm assuming that most people listening to your program are people who stand for peace. So in principle, we may oppose all weapons tests. But I think we have to also recognize that North Korea has a sovereign right to test weapons, which is an essential part of developing its deterrence capability against U.S. nuclear threats. I think that we get confused by the Western media, which demonizes North Korea, but I think we need to be clear that the real threat in this situation is the U.S., and the only way to resolve this crisis is for the U.S. to remove its threat of nuclear force strike against North Korea.
What I find it kind of extraordinary is that the THAAD missiles were put in place during this the rallies and protests and the final removal of South Korean President Park Geun-hye, as if this was all extraneous to U.S. power and influence. The U.S. really doesn't care what happens in South Korea as long as it follows American dictates. And it makes me wonder, who does the South Korean army, the ROK, answer to, Seoul or Washington?
Well, you're exactly right. The U.S. Really, you know, with the THAAD deployment decision, this was clearly another example of U.S. exercising its control over South Korea. Experts have pointed out that the THAAD system is not capable of nor intended to protect the people of South Korea, but more likely the system will be deployed to serve U.S. interests. If we look at even just the process of how the decision was made to deploy the system, we can see that it's a clear illustration of how the South Korean military answers to Washington. There was no democratic process whatsoever. It didn't go through the South Korean parliament or the National Assembly. There was no review process of any sort. Not to mention, as you said, since October of last year, the South Korean government was in a political crisis. The recently impeached Park Geun-hye was embroiled in a corruption scandal, was being investigated, and yet there was no intention of the Pentagon, the U.S. Pentagon, to recognize the situation, let alone reconsider the THAAD decision. And now that the Park Geun-hye administration has been done away with, they're impeached, the leading presidential candidate, Moon Jae-in, has called for the THAAD deployment decision to be reviewed by the National Assembly, by the South Korean National Assembly, but the U.S. Pentagon has ignored that completely, and it has already sent key parts of the missile system to a military base in South Korea. And all this time, the people who live near the proposed deployment site, the people of Songju County, have adamantly opposed the deployment decision from the beginning, and yet both the South Korean Defense Ministry and the U.S. government have failed to consider the residents' concerns and demands.
Well, this is very typical of U.S. attitude toward peoples of color around the world. I mean, the people of Okinawa, we know, have been protesting for years, unfortunately, with little support from American anti-war activists to get U.S. bases out of Japan. This has been, I guess it started in the Spanish-American War, grabbing Guam and the Philippines in 1898, and it hasn't ceased. And it's interesting that before I called you, I mentioned that before the Korean War, the war, actually, I guess they called it the American War in Korea, but the war on U.S. intervention in Korea in 1950, that there was a movement to reunite both Koreas, which had been launched by the North, which the U.S. opposed. And we saw the same thing later happen in Vietnam a decade later, that the United States did not want people to come together in these countries. Perhaps you could talk about the dividing, keeping people divided for U.S. foreign policy interests.
Yeah. You know, we should mention that U.S. control of South Korea goes way back, even before the Korean War, to 1945. When the Japanese surrendered and they ceded colonial control over Korea, a lot of people don't know that the U.S. set up a military government in the southern half of Korea under a general named General Hodge. The U.S. was interested in containing the spread of communism in Asia. So they set up a military government, and then they installed a puppet leader, a man educated in the U.S. by the name of Sun Man-ri. Hodge and Ri carried out systematic and protracted counter-revolutionary violence to decimate what they called communist insurgents. And most of those people were people who had fought for national independence under Japan's colonial rule. 100,000 people, that's by a conservative estimate, were killed in the late 1940s by security forces that were directed and installed by the United States. And then during the Korean War, from 1950 to 1953, the U.S. carried out 3 years of very intense bombing, a reckless land war. Who started this war? It has been the subject of debate. There is a lot of evidence that questions the official narrative. I think I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War is a good resource. But at any rate, the devastation caused by the U.S. during the war was so great that a U.S. general famously stated at a Senate hearing at the end of the war, there is nothing left standing, there were no more targets in Korea. And Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Air Force during the Korean War, also said, over a period of 3 years, we burned down every town in North Korea, every town in South Korea, and killed off 20% of the Korean population. And then at the end of the war, of course, it was the United States, not South Korea, that signed the armistice, which is basically a temporary ceasefire where the two sides agreed to stop fighting. In the armistice, it said, within 3 months of signing this, there should be a conference to discuss the withdrawal of all foreign troops and a peaceful settlement to this conflict. That conference never happened. China withdrew its troops from the Korean Peninsula, but the U.S. did not. It still keeps 28,500 troops there 65 years later. And since then, the South Korean military has been under the command of U.S. generals, which means it has wartime operational control. If a war breaks out in Korea, it would be the U.S. that is in charge of South Korean troops. So technically, this ongoing war that has never ended in Korea is between North Korea and the United States. And of course, as Julian mentioned earlier, U.S. leads war games every year that simulate regime collapse in North Korea. These plans include plans for nuclear preemptive strikes. The U.S. calls South Korea an ally, but, the relationship between the U.S. and South Korea has been anything but even. South Korea is essentially a satellite state of the United States, and that's the role that South Korea has played for the past 7 years.
The last voice you heard was that of Win Lee. She and Julian Cho are my guests today, and we're talking about the situation in North Korea. I know the history of South Korean people have come to the streets and protest against injustices, labor injustices, many, many times. It's gratifying to see that across the water. What are the people doing in response to this implantation of a missile not designed to defend them, but to actually bring attacks upon people of South Korea without giving them any protection whatsoever?
Well, so right now, the people who are in the front lines in the fight against the THAAD deployment are holding weekly protests outside of the proposed deployment site. And now that the U.S. knows that where this system is going, which is Sungju County in South Korea, the people opposing the deployment, they have committed or vowed to post up to physically block the military equipment from entering the site. And just to give you a sense of who the people leading this fight are, the residents of Sungju, just to give you a little insight on who they are. Sungju is a small agricultural region where most of the residents are elderly farmers. And historically, they have been conservative. They voted all their lives for the right-wing party. They had voted for the recently impeached President Park Geun-hye. But when the government announced Sungju's deployment site without any consultation with the residents, they were shocked, they felt betrayed. So in response, the residents demanded the deployment decision be rescinded and began protesting the government, which many of them had never done or even imagined doing. And Sungju is also well known for its melon farming, which is the main source of livelihood for the majority of the farmers there. But one of their concerns, besides the threat of war coming to Korea, has to do with the long-term effects of having the THAAD's radar system, which emits radioactive waves so close to their melon fields. The farmers and residents know that the radioactive waves could have adverse effects on the crops they produce, which then can affect the health of the people consuming them. So the residents in Sungju have been holding daily protest actions against the THAAD deployment since last July of 2016 for over 200 days straight. They've also maintained that they're not just fighting to keep it out of their own backyard, but they oppose the THAAD deployment anywhere on the Korean Peninsula. They're also joined by residents of Gimcheon City, which is another city that's very close to the proposed deployment site, and they're joined by one Buddhist clergy who are also organized against the THAAD deployment, and they're there to protect their sacred site of practice. The birthplace of one of their late leaders is near the deployment site, so they want to preserve that area to be a place of peace and spiritual practice. So all these people, farmers, families, community leaders, religious leaders, they're fighting to protect the land and livelihood of the community, which would be threatened by the deployment of the missile system. And right now is actually the busiest season of melon farming, but despite that, they continue to protest. Just the last week, over the weekend, there were one Buddhist priest holding nightly prayer sit-ins in the middle of the road that leads to the deployment site. And the South Korean Defense Ministry ordered police to tear down the protest site and forcibly remove the protesters, which resulted in a few of the protesters actually having to go to the protesters because of the police using excessive force. And we can only expect that this escalation of police violence, there will be more of it as the government begins to bring in the parts for the THAAD system in the next month or so. But the residents have expressed their resolve to continue protecting their land and putting their bodies on the line to physically stop the THAAD battery from entering the deployment site. So we'll see what happens in the next month, how all that plays out.
Now, the people in Seoul for weeks, months have been protesting Park Geun-hye's corruption. I mean, they've been coming out in record numbers continuously, unprecedented. How are they responding to this new crisis in their country?
Yeah, I think we should just say that the impeachment of Park Geun-hye is the culmination of many months of mass protests by broad sectors of the entire South Korean society. So it was truly a victory for the people. The technical grounds for which she was impeached was really about the corruption scandal that she was involved in with her confidant, who used her connection to the president to embezzle money from corporations. But what the mass movement, the people who were out on the streets, were upset about was 4 years of Park Geun-hye's rule, which was really about neo-authoritarian rule. So her labor market reform initiatives, which would make the South Korean labor market more flexible, so more people working flexible, temporary, part-time jobs with no job security or benefits. Also, Park Geun-hye wanted to introduce a government-authored history textbook in the public schools. The list of these things go on and on. She jailed opposition leaders. The president of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions is right now still behind bars for leading mass protests back in 2015. The dissolution of an opposition grassroots political party, the Unified Progressive Party, was forcibly dissolved by the Park Geun-hye administration. The pent-up frustration of the people had been building, and I think the corruption scandal that erupted last November was sort of the last straw that mobilized millions of people onto the streets in Korea as well as overseas finally ousted Park Geun-hye. Now, the South Korea needs to have another election, needs to happen within 2 months. The front runner in that election is a man named Moon Jae-in. He is a leader of the opposition party, a liberal democratic party. He was the former chief of staff for former President Moon Woo-hyun from 2003 to 2008. He pushed forward the Sunshine Policy with North Korea, which was a policy of engaging North Korea through cultural exchanges and economic cooperation. That abruptly ended in 2008 when conservative governments took power, and inter-Korean relations since that time for the past decade have been very tense. If Moon is elected, he will likely reverse South Korea's policy towards North Korea, towards that of engagement. So, for example, reopening the Kaesong Industrial Complex at the DMZ, resuming the Sunshine Policy, et cetera. But, you know, there are still questions about how he will handle other issues. For example, will there be systemic change to all of the government corruption scandal that was exposed through Park Geun-hye's impeachment? You know, will he finally cut off this cozy relationship between, you know, South Korea's conglomerates like Samsung and LG and South Korea's political leaders? That's been sort of the root of the corruption scandal that was recently exposed. Will he continue to pursue the labor market reform and free trade agreement? And what about the SAD deployment? Will he reverse that decision? And I think Julian knows a little bit more about his position on the SAD system.
Has the opposition party, Democratic United Party, made a public statement about THAAD at this point?
Well, so Moon Jae-in and the Democratic United Party, or the Minju Party, as it's known in South Korea, they have not taken an official stance on opposing or supporting the THAAD as of yet. However, they have been critical of the unilateral decision-making process by the U.S. and the incumbent South Korean government. So they've been wanting the THAAD deployment decision to be reviewed by South Korea's National Assembly. And although it is unclear whether Moon Jae-in would reverse the decision if he is elected as the president in May, the U.S. may be uncertain that it could easily influence a liberal president like Moon Jae-in, as it was able to do in the past with more conservative right-wing presidents like Park Geun-hye, which is precisely why the Pentagon has been so aggressive in pushing the THAAD deployment forward, because it wants to get this done before any major political change happens in South Korea. But on the other side, of course, as I mentioned, those opposing the THAAD, the people on the ground, their strategy is to delay the deployment as long as possible and keep pressuring the presidential candidates like Moon Jae-in to commit to reversing the deployment decision if and when they are in power. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully, Moon Jae-in is able to come out with a definitive statement or position on the issue in the next month.
Of course. Then he would have to worry about Washington, whether it's a Trump or Obama administration or whoever administration in Washington would not take kindly to an administration in Korea that did not follow Washington's dictates, no?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Trump administration is reportedly undergoing a comprehensive review on U.S. policy towards North Korea. And presumably that's why State Secretary Rex Tillerson was in Asia meeting with various allies, basically to make sure that, you know, everyone's approaches are calibrated with Washington. It's unclear exactly what the Trump administration's, policy will ultimately be. Presumably, it was reported in the Washington Journal Wall Street Journal in March, on March 1st, that everything is on the table, from military strike to actually recognition of North Korea as a nuclear state. So anything in between is on the table.
I wanted to get to talk about the role of China, the pressure being put on China by Washington to intervene, as if the U.S., China has to clean up the U.S.'s mess all the time. Maybe you could talk on the China relationship at this particular moment.
Many officials in Washington are always quick to say China needs to do more to put pressure on North Korea. And, you know, Trump tweeted exactly the same thing a few days ago. But I think the Washington needs to realize that, of course, U.S. and China have very different strategic interests. So outsourcing U.S. policy on North Korea to China just simply will not work. China has made very clear that if the United States wants its cooperation on North Korea, it should first reverse the decision on the THAAD deployment. China considers the THAAD system, if it's based in South Korea, a threat to its security because the radar that's attached to the THAAD system can be used for surveillance on Chinese missile activity. And, you know, as Julian talked about earlier, the Pentagon is in a hurry to deploy the THAAD system before the next South Korean administration is in power. So that's going to make it very difficult for the U.S. to get Chinese cooperation on North Korea. I think Xi Jinping is supposed to meet with Trump in April. That's going to be top on their agenda. So we'll see how their conversation goes. And also in terms of Chinese interests in the region, the last thing that China wants is the collapse of the North Korean regime, which will lead to a refugee crisis at its border. And also, it does not want a unified Korean Peninsula that is led by a pro-U.S. South Korean government as its neighbor. So, again, very different strategic interests. Also, you know, Trump has been threatening a trade war against China. So how he's going to get China on board to solve a crisis that is essentially, as you said, a problem between the U.S. and North Korea, that is the million-dollar question.
And what about Japan's role?
Yeah, well,
Shinzo Abe wants to militarize Japan.
Yeah, that's right. Abe has basically undermined Japan's peace constitution, and Japan has been rearming with full U.S. backing. The U.S. has been pushing for a trilateral alliance between U.S., Japan, and South Korea. And there's greater urgency for the U.S. because China's influence in the region is growing stronger. Missile defense is a central part of that trilateral alliance plan. The tricky issue here is that, you know, South Korea, you know, many people in South Korea across the political spectrum do not like the idea of a military alliance with Japan because Japan has not apologized for its past war crimes, including sexual slavery of comfort women during World War II by the Japanese Imperial Army. They conscripted young women for sexual services for the army. And the grandmothers who were victims of this have been protesting for years for an official apology and for Japan to take legal responsibility for this. Japan has refused to do that. This is a very sensitive issue between the two countries. So that's been the roadblock for the trilateral alliance. But the U.S. has been aggressively pushing to get the two countries on board. And the Park Geun-hye administration did a rushed backdoor deal with Japan last fall, even in the midst of the political corruption crisis, where Park Geun-hye's approval rating dropped to a record 4%. She had no legitimacy. She still went ahead at U.S. behest to sign a deal that is called a General Security of Military Intelligence Agreement. It's basically an agreement between the two countries that would allow their militaries to share intelligence. And then the U.S. THAAD deployment basically completes that picture. So the bigger picture is that the missile defense radars in Japan and South Korea would gather information about North Korea and possibly Chinese missile activity and then send that to command centers in the United States. That's the plan, the overall vision that the U.S. is moving towards. Also, you know, in the event of a crisis on the Korean Peninsula, it is conceivable that Japanese so-called self-defense forces enter Korea to provide rear guard support for U.S. troops. In that event, they are required to receive prior consent if they go into any third country to provide support for U.S. troops. They need to receive prior consent. However, in South Korea, there is this question because the U.S., you know, has it's the U.S. forces in Korea that has operational control over South Korea in the event of an emergency. So how that consent would be given, it would presumably be given by the U.S., not South Korea. So, you know, all of those questions are in play when we talk about Japan's role in the region.
Well, we might have to come back to you again. I think we will, as this situation continues to develop. I'm really happy to have had you and Julian Cho, Win Lee and Julian Cho from Zoom in Korea. And I suggest you check out their website, Zoom in Korea, for information on the Korean Peninsula that you do not get in the mainstream media and not much in the alternative either as well, although I know you've been interviewed on Pacifica and KPFA and so on, which I'm happy to see. Thanks so much for being our guest today and informing us on what's going on over there. And sorry
Thank
for that,
you very
that
much,
problem.
Jeffrey.
Take care, Win, and good luck, and look forward to speaking with you again. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.